Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. My guest today, a Navy veteran of World War II, although if you looked at him, you wouldn't believe he's old enough for that. He's only 83, and he looks even younger than that. He is the mayor of Noonkesterville. You know where that is? Well, it's not in Jenks, Oklahoma, although it kind of looks like it if you look at the signs leading up to Benny Noonkester's home in Coarse Gold, California. That's where that is. Now, we might get to some of those details, but let's talk about growing up, because if you're born in October of 27, you're only 14 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. I bet you still have a very distinct memory about that day, though, December 7th, 1941.
Yes, I do. I really do. And I was, you know, raised on a farm, and I had a friend, a good friend of mine. His brother was at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed, and so I remember it very well.
Did it kind of change your outlook on the world, the way you saw things? Did it kind of take your breath away? Did it shock you?
Yeah, I even at that age, I wanted to join up, you know. And finally, I did get to do that. And I was very proud that I did get to serve my country.
And you didn't get in at 14, but you did get in a little early. How old were you when you got into the Navy?
I was 16.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I talked to my dad and see if he'd, you know, say that I was 17. You could go in at 17, and he agreed. And that's how it came about.
So you wanted to go in the Navy as opposed to the Army, the Air Corps. Why the Navy?
I don't know. I just, why, I never did think about that, why I did do that. Just one of them things, I guess.
You felt pretty motivated. That what happened on December 7th really stuck with you, and you felt like you had to go do something about it?
Yes, I did. All of my people have fought in every war in this country ever fought, and I just thought that I need to do the same thing.
So I'm sure the Navy was exactly everything you expected it to be, right?
Yes, it was. Yes.
No surprises?
Well, yeah, you know, there was some special discipline and stuff like that, which I believe in that.
You talked about growing up on a farm in Oklahoma. Did you feel like that prepared you a little bit? Did that toughen you up, or did the Navy still have some work to do to make you into a man?
Well, I was in pretty good shape for us, you know, physically. And some certain things I did have to learn, and it was, and I knew that as long as I obeyed and kept my what they told me to do, I'd be all right. I was, and I was with Commodore Britton. I was in his group all during the war, and his we ran the Commodore's barge, and that was real good duty.
And that's from the APA 38, the USS Chilton. Tell us about what kind of ship that is, because there are a lot of different sizes and types of ships in the Navy. Some guys would prefer to be on a nice, big, secure ship, but that's a pretty big target, too. How'd you feel about your assignment to the Chilton?
Well, okay, I really want to go aboard destroyer, but this is an amphibious outfit. APA means amphibious personnel attack. And, you know, we were transporting troops, and I got, especially going into Okinawa, I got to meet a lot of the high-ranking officers and so forth, and it worked out real good.
You said you wanted to go on a destroyer? Why would you want to go on a destroyer? That's what most guys are trying to avoid. They call them tin cans, you know.
I know. Well, when I was on the farm, I hunted all the time, and I was good with a gun, and I liked to shoot. And I thought maybe I could get to do some shooting.
Did you ever get to do much shooting?
Yeah, I became just before I was going invading Japan, I became a gunner on a 20 millimeter. And I got pretty good with that thing. And then I was a gun captain on a 5-inch, a gun turret. And yeah, so I was around guns most of the lot.
Now, I imagine a lot of the guys that you went through training with, that you got ready to go overseas with, were mostly older than you. Did they ever pick on you for being the young one in the group?
Now, they never did know. I just had to be, if I was with the group, I had to be 19 or 25 or whatever it was. No, it worked out real good.
Not to encourage any of our younger listeners to any mischief, but did you have any tricks to appear older or pass yourself as older than you actually were?
No, I don't remember. I really associated myself some of these guys, especially from Louisiana, where we talk the same language and stuff, you know. No, it worked out real good.
So all these years in California, haven't taken that language from you?
Well, a little bit, maybe.
I'm sure if you go back home to Oklahoma, it comes right out, right?
Yeah, by next day. I mean,
so you get into the Navy, and as we talked about, you're only 14 when Pearl Harbor happens. You get in at 16. Were you ever concerned that the war was going to be over before you got to do what you signed up to do?
Well, that might have been because I really wanted to get in there before it did end. And they thought really it was going to be last another 3 years, what I understand, after I got in, I found, you know. But, the atomic bomb stopped that. And we were going to be in that invasion of Japan because we was there all at Okinawa, ready to go. And so probably had to drop that bomb, I wouldn't be here today.
I didn't even have to ask you the question. You answered it for me. And that's the truth. When we are going to hear more about where you were and what you did, people will get a more real understanding of that. So when did you ship off overseas? And what was that like for you? Were you excited to actually get closer to the action? Were you anxious? Were you concerned that maybe you might not be coming back from this trip?
Yeah, I'm not going to say that I wasn't scared. I mean, but I just felt like I was in good hands, and I was anxious to get over there, really. And I stayed. I'd done my entire time in the Navy board ship. I never did duty, have any shore duty or anything. We went into the Philippines first, and Lady Guff, and then Okinawa was there during that 53 days of that.
We're going to talk about those intense 53 days, but what was your first taste of combat? What do you remember about that? The first moment where it really hit you that, this isn't make-believe, this isn't a game, this is for real, and I could die.
Okay, I kind of skipped the Philippines because Okinawa was really the where I got the big experiences. The first day there, I remember I looked up and here come a plane down, straight down, not on an angle, and got a destroyer right near us and killed nearly everybody on there. And it didn't actually sink, but I don't know why it didn't. And that was my experience the first day.
So the first day of the battle, you see a kamikaze take out a destroyer, and that kind of says, uh-oh.
Yeah, it did. then after that was every day. It was like, I don't know. We had 44 separate attacks in one day. And one time there was like 400 planes come in one time. But anyhow, that all them 53 days, day and night.
You say 44 attacks, you mean 44 kamikaze attacks.
Yeah. Yeah, it was 44 kamikaze attacks. Yeah.
So that's pretty much a constant fear that this could happen.
Yeah, it was. That was day and night in that 40 of them, because they come at night also. And you just lose so much sleep till you got where you didn't even care. I mean, it didn't seem to bother you.
Well, yeah, easy for you to say, but hard for us to understand what that was really like for you. What were your duties aboard the ship at that point, and what were you doing during that time where these planes are coming in and trying to end your life?
Well, during that time, I was with the Commodore. We had to be prepared to take him where he needs to be taken. So whatever we'd be on standby, not have a permanent station, and we'd be handing ammunition or filling in someplace. And that's what I was doing at that time. Then later, when I became a gunner, when I was out at sea, that would be a different story. I could have a permit station, but usually on them situations, I just, for in case I could take over somebody else.
Is it safe to say that those 53 days at Okinawa were the most intense 53 days of your life?
Yes, I would. Yeah, I would say that. I grew up real fast.
I bet. And when you talk to people and they realize that you served in the Navy in World War II, they hear maybe the word Okinawa. Do you get a sense that people understand the significance of that battle or the magnitude of it? Because, you know, people focus on Iwo Jima because of the famous photo of the flag atop Mount Suribachi. Maybe they know there were high casualties there. But when you talk about the sheer magnitude of casualties on both sides, Okinawa is one of the bloodiest battles ever.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I feel that. I feel that way. I know we hear more about Iwo Jima, which is, it was sad, but Okinawa did have a lot more casualties. I think you'd combine them all together, be 270,000 lives lost, not counting wounded. Yeah.
And that's when you're talking about civilians and military as well. And nearly 5,000 from the Navy alone were killed at Okinawa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the biggest loss for the Navy in the history of the Navy there.
And when you hear that, I'm sure part of you says, I'm thankful I wasn't one of them. How close did you come to being one of them?
Oh, well, we got hit by a kamikaze, and I thought that was it. That's quite a story. I don't know where you want to got time for that or not.
Oh, we definitely have time, and I think our listeners are waiting to hear it from you. So you can start that wherever it starts for you in terms of your recollection. Set that stage and paint that picture for us.
Yeah, okay. Well, this was in the evening of April the 2nd, and I was way down in our compartment, which is the bottom of the ship, and all at once there's this big explosion. At that time, you went up on starboard and down on port, and we exited out of what, there's 50 of us down there maybe. We got out of there okay, and I was wanting to get topside. I don't know where we're sinking or what have you, and I'll really have to cut this short because it's a big story. But
no, don't cut it short. This is an hour-long program, so you have all the time in the world. Don't cut it short.
I'll just tell you about a good buddy of mine. I went through the gallery, and he had been up on the bridge, and he was all soaked with water and everything, and he had done lost it. He was plumb gone. I mean, he was so scared. He was, and I talked to him a little bit, and I hadn't seen daylight yet. I want to get out of where I don't know where we're going down or what. And I finally had to leave him, and he just went over in a corner and got down in the fetal position. He couldn't help himself or nothing. If we went down, he'd have went down. And I went up topside, and now scattered around on the deck was pieces of body and bodies and planes all over the deck. And I'm standing there because this day I'm just a standby for it. I look over at our sister ship, which is the Henrico, the APA 45. It just got hit, and it was burning dead in the water and killed lots of sailors. And I looked up, and here come these. This days we got hit with bombers called Francis, not fighters, but they were bombers. And I looked up, here come a bomber off over our port side, and it was just getting ready to come down on us because it wasn't flying very high. And all at once that plane was coming, and it made a turn. And I looked up the belly of that plane, and it went out and got our escort. Just blew, instead of us, it got that. And I mean, I just turned around and looked up to straight ahead, and about 5 degrees off of the starboard side, I seen another plane coming in. And it was maybe 200 feet above the water. And I said, I waited there. And I said, well, I waited so long. I said, well, now this is it. I'm not going to survive this. It's too close. Can't shoot it down. So I just jumped back down the deck, down in the galley, made about one step down jumped. And waited for it to happen. Thought that was it. It didn't blow, and I went topside, and they got it with a 5-inch on. And I found out 55 years later, talked to the guy, put the sights on that thing, and got it. And so we shot that one down. Then, another minute went by, and I looked over on the starboard side, coming straight in was another bomber. And it was I was just trying to guess the distance from us. If I said 300 yards, I mean, it's coming 200 miles an hour maybe. And it's just ready to make it to hit us. And we shot the left wing off. And it stalled in the air. And I looked at that pilot. I don't know where he shoved that window forward or back and jumped out. Just jumped out in the ocean before it hit, before it crashed, and it hit right at the edge of our ship. And so anyhow, that was that one day, but there's a lot of other ones.
So, I mean, as I hear you describing this, I'm just trying to picture it in my mind, and it almost seems like these Japanese planes, which are not trying to bomb you, they're trying to crash into you and take you out, that they're just swarming around like flies or something.
They did bomb us first. I mean, this one had hit us. I don't know why. He dropped 2 500-pound bombs, just missed us. If he had kept them bombs, we'd have probably went down. And the way I understand what happened there, if you take weight out of a plane, it'd naturally go up. And it hit us high, you know, instead of down maybe where he really wanted to hit us. We'll never know why that happened. But
well, I bet you have your theories on why and how. And it sounds like each one of those you thought could have been it, was probably going to have been it, and none of them were it. Why do you think that is?
Well, I just give God the credit there myself, personally. I really do.
You probably don't have time to pray in that situation,
no.
Do you?
Oh, no. No. There's so much going on. I'm standing there and now looking up and here's a guy out of my division. I'm just like in a graveyard. I mean, I don't know where anybody's at. And I see him walk out and kick that machine gun off that plane, was laying there on the deck just the other side of me, and he kicked it over the side, one of the machine guns I had on there. And that's a 4-man crew on that plane and to operate it and what have you.
And you said that was just one day? So there are other days that maybe weren't quite as intense, but were like that?
Yeah, they was. I mean, there was, I'd say every day there was, it was something, not that bad, but I mean, there was hitting ships around us, and I don't know why we did survive. We went on later on, we was the nearest ship probably when the battleship Pennsylvania got hit and killed a lot of guys. It was right, actually the plane went right over our stack to get that thing, and then we're probably maybe the closest ship to it. Yeah, but anyhow.
Now, what was the severity of the damage to your ship, and do you have any sense for the casualties that those kamikaze attacks caused?
Well, you know, it didn't. We got to run back to States right quick and got repairs done and so forth, and wasn't that bad. They reported, so I can show you in a little bit, where the ride up Tokyo Rose rode up, that they sunk us with no survivors. I've got that here.
I'll have to put a copy of that on our website at kmjnow.com. But you're here to say that's not true. That was a false report.
Yeah, that's a false. That's false.
And he is living proof. We're going to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, more from 83-year-old Benny Noonkester, Navy veteran of World War II, and you've heard some of the close calls. You'll also hear his brush with a very famous journalist who died in World War II and what he can tell us about that situation. Benny Noonkester, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Benny Noonkester of Coarse Gold, California, served on the USS Chilton in World War II, served on other U.S. Navy ships as well. We're going to hear about that. But he mentioned that there was a Tokyo Rose report that his ship had been sunk. Imperial Japanese Navy sinks Chilton with all hands. That was the news on Radio Japan the morning of April 3rd, 1945. And as the Chilton Reunion newsletter notes, those who heard that broadcast were stunned. True, they'd just undergone a grueling experience the evening before when a kamikaze Francis bomber had attempted to crash her and had torn up some of her antennae and damaged a boat davit with a gun mount shield, then exploded in the sea, scattering a machine gun, pieces of aluminum, gasoline, and body parts all over the number 3 hatch. But the inaccuracy of Tokyo Rose's broadcast that day was ludicrous to the extreme. Its effect on the crew was to relieve the tension among the men, the opposite of what she had expected to accomplish. So that's what it says here, Benny. Was that the case? Did you guys get a kick out of Tokyo Rose thinking you guys were all gone?
Yeah. Because she wasn't very honest.
That much we know with certainty now. It describes there the pieces of the plane going into the sea and being scattered across the deck. You've got proof of that right here in your house. You have a little piece of that Japanese airplane that struck your ship?
Yeah, yes, I do. It's got Japanese numbers or writing on it. I don't know what it means, but and I had a lot of other pieces, and I don't know what happened to it.
Well, you've got that one souvenir and other souvenirs from later in your service. But I mentioned before we took that break, a famous American journalist. There is a Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent, very famous at the time, named Ernie Pyle. How did you and your ship come in contact with Ernie Pyle? And was that a big deal to you all at the time? Because you had a Commodore on your ship who was in charge of 30 ships. Was Ernie Pyle a big deal to you guys?
Yes, he was. He was a... He was really a guy that you talk to the common sailor, you know, and he didn't really hobnob with the officers as much as he did maybe the enlisted men. And, yeah, he was a fine guy.
And what do you remember about him being aboard your ship? And tell us the circumstances of his death and what you guys had to do with that.
Well, me, I was on the Commodore's barge. It was just four sailors. And the day of invasion of Aishima, we took him and his party over to the island, and he got killed within minutes when we dropped him off. And it was only a bluff. There was no buildings, or he was like 100 miles from anywhere where we dropped him off. And I remember that very well.
So you guys dropped him. You took the Commodore's barge and dropped him off. When did you hear that he had been killed?
I think that evening, because he got killed maybe a little before noon. I'm not sure. But news spread real fast, you know, about it. And, yeah. So, yeah, and I had patrol duty that night, all night on there, just off the island. And I don't know, I never will know what happened. The ship dropped us off and just left us. And I thought, you know, they didn't come back to get us, even the next day. So I don't know where what they had in mind there. But anyhow, we finally went down the coast of Okinawa and found our ship and got back safely.
What were you guys doing that whole time?
We was waiting on to be, after come daylight the next day, we was waiting to be picked up, you know. And we waited and waited till, I don't know, 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning maybe, and nobody showed up. So we didn't know what happened to the ship. Maybe it was sunk. I don't know.
And your ship was not a huge ship, the APA 38, but the Commodore's barge is like a flea on an elephant, huh?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. So you probably didn't feel all that secure if you're going to have to spend days on the Commodore's barge.
Yeah, I want to tell a little story about what happened that patrol that night. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're traveling across country sometimes, They're not going to rent a motel room. If there are four of you, somebody would say, look, a couple of you guys better sleep because you're going to have to drive after a while. Mm-hmm. So the boat's coxswain said, a couple of you guys better lay down and go to sleep because otherwise that's what we're going to have to do. Well, how are you going to go to sleep? They're shooting. The artillery's going over. I mean, all this explosions and everything. And it just got dark. So me and another sailor just laid down in the boat. And, I mean, it got dark now, and it was so dark you couldn't see nothing. And all at once, I look at the edge of the boat, and here comes up some fingers inside the boat. And then he pulled his head up. And the only reason I could see that the moon was directly behind him. And I could almost touched him. And then I hollered, and he just dropped back in the water, and it's dark. Nobody slept all night.
So these are our Japanese divers.
Yeah, our job was to shoot them because we had some LSTs and so forth shooting rockets out there, and then they'd swim out maybe and blow them up, you know, with explosives. And our job was to intercept them and shoot them.
So the whole purpose of your patrol was to look for these frogmen who were under the water.
Right, yeah, and I'm sure that was one of them. And if he got our boat, he could have been, you know, no telling what he could have done.
So I imagine... And I don't want to suggest anything and create anything, but I've talked to so many veterans who have had nightmares and flashbacks over the years. That sounds like something that would stick with you, that when you see that image, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, for 40 years probably. you know, the ship was sinking or what have you, but I finally got over that.
And you probably kind of don't know what to do in that moment, do you?
No, you really don't. You know, it was so much. We were so close to the island on the patrol in there that you could see them shooting flares up, and somebody with rifles was trying to shoot them down before they hit the ground. And the artillery is going over also at the same time, and it was something.
it sounds like the kind of extreme circumstances that can make you crazy or make you lose focus. What do you think kept you focused? How did you keep going day to day with everything happening around you, the constant threat of kamikazes, the fear that you could lose your life? What do you think kept you motivated and focused?
Well, I always had a buddy or two. We could talk, and that really helped things. In fact, that buddy that I told you that was so scared. After that, he had to say, "Benny, let's go up topside and talk." He was a changed guy, really, and I'd take time out to spend time with him, and that it helped me too.
And you were all of 17 years old.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, you're 17.
It's hard to believe. You know, you talked about the Commodore's barge, and I've seen a picture on the wall of your home of the Commodore's barge next to the ship, the Chilton, and there really is a huge size difference here. And the way you got from your ship to that barge was a little tricky, too. In fact, in that picture, you're not sure if the sailor going between the ship and the barge might be you. But explain for our listeners how you would go from the ship to that little boat to go on a patrol or like taking Ernie Pyle to Aishima or whatever you did.
Well, now, when we took him, we had a gangplank to go down. But like on where I was, that one picture you seen, we had to walk that boom out, and a little ladder went down. And it was really, you had to be in good shape and be damp, and it would slip and fall off that thing.
And then you're in the drink.
Yeah, right.
And I do have a picture of that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, in addition to many other pictures relating to Benny's service during World War II. Some of the souvenirs he brought back from Japanese prisoners, a piece of that kamikaze airplane, the rifle he brought home. Many pictures on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page that you can link through the article about Benny on KMJNow.com. You mentioned the number 53 days at Okinawa with your ship. Did it seem longer than that? How hard was it to, and did you feel like that battle might never end?
Yeah, because we didn't know for sure that, how long they, how many days they thought that would take, but it took a lot longer. I'm going to tell you that what it means, I've just thought of something. It's okay. When we was going our way to invade Okinawa, one day I was walking down through the passageway and I seen a hatch door open, and it was Army officers in there. And I just slipped in, and they were briefing the other officers on what to expect there, about casualties and deadly snakes and all this stuff. And I just stayed in there and listened. I guess they thought I was somebody. They didn't realize a 17-year-old kid.
So did that turn out to be a good thing that you knew what to expect, or was it a bad thing because you knew what to expect?
Just make you think you want to be a little leery where you walked and what have you. Yeah.
And I don't know if we touched on this because we talked about the kamikaze attacks and everything you experienced aboard ship. Were you a part of taking troops to shore? Because the whole purpose of your ship is to land troops for invasion forces. Were you ever a part of that, of ferrying troops from the ship to shore?
No, we didn't. On account of, we was any time we were anchored or tied up or whatever, our responsibility was the Commodore, you know, to transport him to different ships and what have you. Was right there with them, because we had, you know, had the Army board, and I was, yeah, we was around them a lot. And then, in fact, we was operated as a hospital ship too. They'd bring the wounded in and take care of them.
Was that hard for you as someone with your whole life in front of you? Here you're 17 years old and you see guys that are 18, 19, 20, you know, in their early 20s who are wounded, who are dead. How hard was that to see on a daily basis? Do you get desensitized to it eventually, or does it bother you every day?
Well, I think you sort of get used to it. I don't know how many of these guys, wounded guys, would die, but, you know, I was thinking about when we took these soldiers in there, and for the days over here, a lot of them are back wounded, standing in line for to be, you know, taken care of. And you'll think about it.
And I imagine with everything you've described for us, And the fact that you were on that ship, that you made friendships, you had buddies. How often would it happen that somebody that you had actually gotten to know fairly well was a price of the war, paid the ultimate price? Is that something that you experienced, having your buddies die?
No, not really. Just always wounded and stuff like that. Buddies of mine, but not really any of the close to anyone got killed or anything like that. Yeah.
You did mention seeing your sister ship on that night of the kamikaze attacks, seeing your sister ship take that direct hit and great loss of life aboard the Henrico. How did that affect you guys on your ship?
Well, yeah, I mean, we had to, we couldn't even help them. We had to see, when you're under attack, you have to go full speed. And we just left her burning in the water, dead in the water, burning, big black smoke. And there was one man aboard that ship that survived. It was Winifred Rockefeller was on that ship and survived it. But we had to go right on off and leave them. And then the ship that was sunk up ahead of us, we didn't stop to pick them up either, because we'd have to stop. And like the one sailor asked the Commodore about picking up that Japanese that jumped out of the plane. He said, we can't jeopardize like 650 lives for one. We can't do that, you know.
And that's probably hard for some people to understand, but it sure makes sense to you now, doesn't it?
All right, I'm glad you mentioned that. This guy that asked the Commodore that question, his name was Williamson, I believe. We come back and got the repairs in the state, and when they was shipping out the next morning real early, they had to take him off. He lost his mind. That same guy. Yeah.
Is there a reason that you kept your wits about you? Was it that you were too young to know any better? Was it part of your upbringing? What do you think carried you through?
Well, it's probably some of my upbringing, probably. And I don't know. I never did really think I was going to get killed, but except that one time, I just knew that was it. But I don't know. I didn't. I definitely wasn't in a position that I was ready to go, because I wasn't.
Well, I'm glad you didn't go. Some people say maybe they had letters from home, or they had something to read that would get their mind straight. Did you have anything like that, anything that you carried around that kind of gave you that sense of peace or connection or a reason to survive?
No, I don't think so. Not that I remember right now. My dad was a man that I thought he could do anything, and I probably think more about him he was supporting me and so forth, and that'd be the closest probably.
When that battle at Okinawa finally wrapped up, was that cause for celebration aboard your ship? Did you guys actually have a clear indication that it was actually over?
All right, I'm glad you mentioned that. We got a false report 3 days before the war actually ended, and now I'm a gunner on that 20mm, and I run up and strap myself the gun to celebrate. Well, they passed word right quick for us not to do that, and we didn't. A lot of the ships did. Killed a lot of guys. I know the man from Clovis, Clyde Barnett, the undertaker at Clovis, he was telling me about it there at the same time. Had killed 9 guys on his ship. That stuff going up's got to come down, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what happened. They opened up, lit up the sky celebrating.
So thinking back, you wouldn't have tried to do that?
No, no, no.
Did you feel any different when it was over, or did you have any more of a sense of security?
Well, I felt a little more grown up, I guess you'd say. Yeah, it changed me a lot, really did. That kind of stuff, it just kind of gets to you.
Well, and Okinawa was over, but the World War II Navy service of Benny Noonkester was not over. When we come back, we'll find out what else he did for Uncle Sam during World War II. The rest of Hometown Heroes straight ahead here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It's been fun visiting today with Benny Noonkester of Coarse Gold, California, the mayor of Noonkesterville, if you want to be sure. That's what the sign says in front of his house, and I'm not going to argue with it. But he was half a world away, or I guess a whole world away, during World War II. You heard him describe his experiences aboard the USS Chilton at the Battle of Okinawa. Also how he was one of the sailors who, on Commodore Britton's barge, transported Ernie Pyle to the island of Aoshima, where the famous war correspondent, was killed, remains a hero to journalists all over the world for his martyrdom, I guess you would say, during World War II. Ernie Pyle does, and Benny Nooncaster interacted with him. Some other famous folks as well, we'll hear about that. And we'll hear the ships he served on after that APA 38, the USS Chilton. Now, a famous general of the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II was Hap Arnold, and I understand you had some interactions with him as well?
Yes, we did. We picked him up at Okinawa, our boat crew, and took him out the ship to meet with the Commodore Britton. And I remember him very well, a little short fellow. And, yeah. Now, I don't know where that was, when we was getting ready to invade Japan or went into Korea, because we went into Korea right away instead of in Japan. We were the first expeditionary force into Korea, and went in there, and we had a lot of prisoners and Australian prisoners there, and I got to see them. It was really terrible.
What struck you? You talk about it being terrible, and clearly there's a lasting impression in your mind. Describe it for us. What was so jarring to see?
Well, when we got there, they Japanese officials turned them loose because they knew we were coming. And in fact, they went to killing some of the guards, I understand. And they ran right by me to get down to get something to eat or whatever. And they were so poor. They were just skin and bones. But they were hollering and hooping and carrying on because some of them had been prisoners for 3 years or longer maybe. But I'll never forget that.
And when you see that, does that kind of remind you what you're there for? That there have been people that have been suffering for all this time and maybe what you're doing has a small role in them getting their freedom back?
Yes, it does. It really does. Yeah, that gives you a good feeling. They survived and are going to get to go home.
Now, here you are, a teenager from Oklahoma, and you're seeing a whole bunch of parts of the world that you probably could have only imagined before that. It doesn't sound like much of a sightseeing trip, though. What was it like the time you spent on Korea? And were you still on the Chilton at that time, or had they moved you to another ship?
I was still on the Chilton. And from there, we went into North China. We were the first in the North China, Tsingtao and Chiwantao, and went down to Hong Kong immediately and went into transporting Chiang Kai-shek's 8th and 13th Army, start fighting the communists. And that's what we done for a while.
So here they told you the war is over, and here's another war, huh?
Yeah, I know one town, in Tsingtao we went in, and we had this General Lee. We transported him up there, and had a big brass band that met us, and they're shooting. The artillery's going off right there. I mean, we could hear it real plain.
And I imagine if you survive kamikaze attacks and everything you saw in the Navy while World War II and the war between America and Japan was still going on, you really didn't want to get killed when the war was over.
No, goodness, no. I stayed over there until I got out. I got into Shanghai and in out of Hong Kong, in the Philippines. I was back in, went in Manila a time or two, and so I got to go to in a lot of places. Of course, I was in a lot of the islands out there too.
And then they took you from an APA, which is a smaller ship in comparison, and put you on a carrier, the Hancock. What was that all about?
Well, I don't know. That's where they transferred me. I was supposed to be going to a deep sea diving school in Washington, D.C., and they'd lost my records. So they put me on the Hancock, and I stayed there for a few months. And then we went back out in the Pacific. And we got back as far as Pearl Harbor, and one night was leaving early the next morning to come to the States. Just before dark, my division officer came to me and said, "We got to have your rate back." And I had to go back out the other direction. Boy, that was a downer.
What was the reason for that?
He just said, "This, you're not being Shanghai, they just need your rate." So I went back, and that's when I went on the Boxer. And that's a big story there. I mean,
Well, let's hear it. The USS Boxer was another aircraft carrier. You ended up on it for over a year?
Yeah. I'm at Pearl Harbor and Honolulu, and I get on a plane. They flew me to China, and I ended up hopping around to get over there. And when I landed out north, way out in a cow pasture. There wasn't no airstrip. There wasn't even no buildings out there. and landed out there. And we had them old Army trucks, you know, you can only see out the back of them, you know, canvas over them. Well, there was a Chinese driving this truck, and he couldn't speak English, and he was sitting up there by himself. I wanted to see the country. So I got up there with him, and an officer come along, kicked me out. And I got back, and he went somewhere, and when he left, I got back up there. Anyhow, I rode into town. I did get to see the country. We was way out there somewhere. The roads had holes in them, and they put us in some Japanese barracks. The Japanese, that's what used to be their barracks, and kept me there for a while and put me on a LST and sent me down the Huangpu River out in the ocean and going down the coast of China to Hong Kong. And I look out. I said, boy, I could see lights. After a few days, I see lights of Hong Kong. I'm going to get Pearl Liberty tonight. I looked off, and I could see some lights blinking. And here comes a whale boat, picks me up, puts me aboard a destroyer, and I travel a few days on that destroyer, and I come, we catch up with the boxer, and they shoot a lion over there, and that's the way I went aboard the boxer. We didn't even slow down, where they put you in this little thing, and it's kind of scary, but that's the way I went aboard the boxer.
You didn't walk across. You zipped along a line to the big carrier.
Yeah. And far as I know, I was the only one that they'd done that. I don't think anybody went with me. I don't know. I didn't think I was that important.
Well, I guess you were. There must have been something special about you. Now, the war's over. You're on this carrier for more than a year after the war is all over. Where I know you had been itching to get in the service. You signed up at 16. But by this point, were you ready to come home and do something else?
Yeah, I really was. Terrible, terrible thing happened. My dad went up in the foothills with a couple other guys up in Morgan Canyon and run off the road and killed all of them. And I was the oldest in the family, and I need to be home. So they let me out a little early, which that's okay. That's what I wanted to do. And so anyhow, I've thought a lot of times maybe if I could have stayed in. But it had been altogether different, no doubt.
Well, it sounds like you've been able to live quite a life since you did make home. When there are a lot of nights in the Pacific, you didn't know if you'd wake up the next day. So when you did get back to the United States, do you get a special feeling about stepping back on American soil again, knowing all the lives that paid the price for America to remain free?
Yeah, I did. You know, yet you're young, you're not thinking right, and it was rough for a while after losing my dad, because he was actually, you know, he was the leader of the whole family. I mean, if you needed advice or whatever, you could go to him. And it was kind of rough for a while on that account.
Yeah, you talked about growing up in a hurry in World War II. You had to grow up in a hurry again there. One thing that I always like to find out from veterans, because obviously there were some close calls for you, like anyone who served in World War II. And when I interviewed my own grandfather and talked about him nearly being killed, I told him I was glad he didn't. He said, yeah, you wouldn't be here. And I know that's the case. You didn't have any children when you went into the service at age 16. So I know that all your descendants came after you got home from World War II. How many children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren wouldn't be here if you didn't survive?
Yeah, I got three children. I got a son and two daughters and five grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. Yeah.
They can all go in your room, and they can see the big game that you've hunted down on the wall, and they can see your Navy photos and medals and all that. When they ask you, Grandpa, what was World War II about? What were you guys doing over there? Why'd you have to do it? How do you answer questions like that?
Yeah, well, you just say that, you know, what the situation there, we were attacked, and we had to, and I just believed in it. We defend ourselves. Holy. In fact, maybe I mentioned before, my people, I had fought in every war had been fought, I guess, and a lot of them had been killed in even the Revolutionary War, War of 1812, Civil War, and all. And I just believe in being patriotic, and I think we all should do that.
Do you think people today understand what happened in World War II, how big of a deal it was, and how much of an impact it has on the lives they lead today?
No, I don't. I've asked that question sometimes, and they don't even know, maybe I never heard the name before, whatever you're talking about. Maybe they're not teaching enough in school or whatever it is. They're not interested. Yeah, I feel that way.
when you look back on it, you think about the guys that you served with, the times where maybe you could have been killed, the people that you met. What sticks with you the most? What do you think you're most proud of or most thankful for in terms of your time in the Navy?
Well, I'm glad I got to do it, and I'd do it again. And it was the right thing to do, as far as I'm concerned. And if you want to hear another little thing that happened. One time at Okinawa, in the afternoon, me and some other sailor buddy was up on the bridge, and we heard a loud explosion over on the island, a big bang. We looked over, we didn't know what it was, but just a little bit, we knew what it was. If you know what a 16-inch gun is, we call it the bullet, was coming our way like a freight train. It was just making so much noise. Went right over our heads, and we were broadside to the island, and it went on the other side of us and hit the water. And so it's after hours, and about 2 minutes or whatever took them long to load it up again, we heard that explosion again. Well, we know that what you got to do, because they're looking right down on from the island, looking right down, it's like a duck in a tub, you know. They had the vertical hair perfect, but the horizontal hair was high. All they had to do is crank that hair down. And I expected that next one to get us. And if he got us for that 16, it blew us plumb out of the water. Wouldn't he maybe not have been a survivor? They didn't crank it down enough. Missed it again. They shot at us three times, not lowering the hair enough, and we got away. Well, pretty soon we turned our stern to that thing and got out of there.
It sure seems when you tell stories like that that maybe you feel like somebody was looking out for you.
Yeah, you know, that's right. I don't know where I mentioned, but we were strafed and shelled many numbers of times and bombed and hit. And I often think myself, being around that stuff and so many of much stuff going on, how we even made it. You know, you look around and they come in at night and bomb at night. And one day I talked to the sailor and said, they sunk a ship right here by us last night. You know, coming and bombing. A lot of times they'd put a smoke screen around us, try to cover us up. But that didn't. Sometimes they'd just get up so far and you'd be high and dry. The bridge would be where they could see, you know.
And I guess that wouldn't be what you'd want to wake up to, knowing that this ship next to you got sunk. But I'm glad they missed you. I'm glad you're around, and I think your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids are too. Betty, thank you for serving our country and for telling me a little bit about it.
Thank you. I'm glad to get to do it, all right? And because today, you know, nobody or a lot of people don't even know about it. I mean, they're not interested anyhow. Something they've never been heard very much about. And I'll talk to you about it if you ask me.
Well, we're thankful for that, and hopefully the folks listening have learned a little bit about it today. That's our program for this week. Thanks to Benny Nooncaster. Can you believe he's only 83 years old? And if you saw him, you'd think he was 70. You can see online for yourself, kmjnow.com. I'll post a picture of Benny then and now. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.